Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Plötzlich fühle ich mich so entspannt.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Tiefenentspannt mit Wieso-Steuer.
Stu does America.
Subscribe to us at youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica. Be sure to hit the bell for notifications. Get your Stu Does America merch as well. StuDoesMerch.com. The code is Stu10. Get 10% off your entire order. How exciting is that? I should also tell you, we have live coverage coming up tomorrow night of Trump's big speech. We'll get into a little bit of details of that, but I think it starts 7:30 p.m. Eastern. Check it out, blazetv.com/Stu. Got a big panel here. We'll have the whole speech for you live. Going to be a great night of coverage. Ryan Burge is also going to be here today to look at the state of religion in America. Illegal border crossings continue to plummet. Who would have thought having an actual border strategy would be so effective? It's weird. We also have a massive Andrew Cuomo update coming your way. Don't panic. He's still awful. But we're going to start by doing Trump versus Zelensky. What a freaking show that was, huh? I mean, I've never in my life seen anything like that when it comes to allies in front of a camera. When it comes to diplomacy, I don't think I've ever seen anything like that. I mean, that was legitimately shocking to see. Just an absolute firefight between Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, and then Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine. Now, he's coming, supposedly, to the United States to sign some mineral deal. At least that's what we were told. And then the whole thing goes up in flames. Trump berates Zelensky in fiery exchange at the White House. Of course, this is how the New York Times is reporting it. Not that there was anything on the other side of that at all. It was just Trump berating Zelensky. That's all you need to know about it. And I will say, like, I saw the clip you probably saw, okay, initially, which was, and we'll get to it here, I'll play it for you, just so you have perspective and in case you haven't seen it. But basically, J.D. Vance saying, look, this is disrespectful for you to fight this out in front of the American media. Zelensky and Trump trading barbs back and forth after that. It kind of blew up into this big thing. And I think when you saw that, it was interesting because you feel like, what is this? What is the Ukrainian position right now? Where are they? What's their position in the world? They've had a lot of support from the United States. There's obviously a danger of that either going away completely or changing in a significant way with Trump, a new president coming in with a new policy, a new strategy, a different desire, maybe not to back them for as much as it takes for as long as it takes, the kind of famous Biden standard, but instead going to a position where, hey, I want to wind this war up. We want this, you know, we still want Ukraine to have its sovereignty, but we want this to be over. And that's more of the priority for Trump. So you'd expect a person coming to this country to say, oh my gosh, like, I know I'm in a precarious position with the United States. I can't lose their support. What do I do to maintain it? And that kind of made sense with the idea of a mineral deal coming to be signed as a first step in that process. Maybe there are security guarantees. Maybe there are other support mechanisms. Maybe our people are there getting the minerals, and that means that, you know, Russia's not going to want to invade the country, right? Like, there's a lot that could be going on there. But you kind of see what the Zelensky approach should be, which is keep this support, keep the gravy train going, right? Like, whatever you need to do to keep the gravy train going, because without it, you're probably no longer a nation, right? That's the sort of real issues that people in Ukraine are facing. And, you know, look, you can have your problems with Zelensky. I totally understand that and have many of them myself. That being said, I do think that if I was a Ukrainian citizen, like, I'd see this as, like, pretty cut and dried. Like, we got invaded and I'm pissed off about it and I want to get that territory back. I could see that being the position of the average Ukrainian. And a lot of those people had nothing to do with the arrangements made or you may think canceled by previous regimes, tinkering, if you would, by the United States and other Western nations. Obviously, you know, the Russians have their part in this, too, and I think it's a big part. They're the ones that crossed the border. They're the ones that created this invasion. They're the ones that went in 2014. They're the ones that have multiple times signed agreements to guarantee Ukrainian sovereignty and don't seem to be all that much on that bandwagon anymore. So there's a lot going back. You can always find that stuff going back into the past. But here we are now, and with an active war, one that I think nobody wants anymore. Like, even the Russians who went in there and tried to take the entire country failed at that. They now have a chunk of the territory, but these lines have not moved in a long time. We're just having needless death at this point, it would seem. So I looked at this and said, okay, if that's the approach of Zelensky, which you'd think almost unquestionably it would be, right? What went on? How did this blow up? How could this possibly have happened? And there's something to entertain there. Because if you saw the clip that everyone saw, it was kind of J.D. Vance increasing the tensions in that one clip, right? Zelensky is saying some stuff, but, you know, it's Vance that comes in and says, hey, don't be disrespectful to my president. And that's where it really pumps up from. Now, it's easy if you're the media. I gave you the headline from The New York Times. Trump berates Zelensky. You can kind of like take that and not even look any deeper. Or you could do the work of actually going back and looking at the entire context of the clip. And that's what I wanted to do, because I wanted to see if I could understand how did this happen? Because, again, I can't put a fine enough point on this. It's one of the most incredible diplomatic outcomes that we've seen in a really long time. I can't think of any other great example. Certainly you see, you know, situations where presidents with enemies will go in front of the United Nations and just berate another country. We've done that plenty of times. You've seen the situation. I remember Hugo Chavez talking about George W. Bush and saying, this guy, he smells of sulfur and he's basically the devil. And then actually having some Democrats come out and say, look, I don't like George W. Bush, but he's my president, and shut up about him. You have that type of thing that does happen from time to time. You're supposed to be allies, right? Like, we're supposed to be allied with this country. This almost never happens to this degree in front of cameras. It might happen behind closed doors. And honestly, at some level, it's healthy for it to happen behind closed doors. But it was just shocking to see. So I thought it would be worth going back and seeing what led up to this. How can we understand the motivations of this moment? So let me go back to the beginning, because you probably haven't seen this entire thing. Understandably, you have a life, which I don't have. So let me give you a little some of the outtakes from early on. This is at the very beginning of this. Look at the way this meeting starts with Trump, Zelensky, and Vance.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to have President Zelensky of Ukraine. And we've been working very hard, very close. They have great fighters. And you have to be very proud of them from that standpoint. But now we want to get it over with. It's enough. They're very serious about it. And we'll make a deal. And when the deal is made, I don't think we talk about security. Everyone's talking about the other day. All they talked about was security. I said, let me make the deal first.
Now, does that look familiar at all to you? To me, that looks like every other meeting Donald Trump has ever had in public with a foreign leader, right? He is saying nice things about the country. He's saying nice things about their fighters. He's saying he wants to make a deal that's going to make everything better. We can solve this. We can do better. That is every single meeting Donald Trump's ever had. Right? Like, there's nothing out of the ordinary there whatsoever from what Trump is doing. Any competent world leader going into a meeting with Donald Trump would immediately recognize that is the tone he is taking. Let me give you a little bit more. And I should also point this out. This happened, the stuff I'm showing you here, happened a half an hour before the blow up. So, like, it kind of feels like, oh, they have these quick little press availabilities. They say hello, they shake hands, and then they move on. Oh my gosh, it blew up at it. No, this was a half an hour buildup to the moment that everybody was playing. Here's another clip. This is, again, from earlier on in the meeting with Trump and Zelensky.
They really gave a lot, Mr. President.
They did.
They gave a lot,
but they gave much less.
No.
Talk about Europe.
No.
No.
Don't argue with it.
No.
Okay. You want me to be tough? I could be tougher than any human being you've ever seen. I'd be so tough. But you're never going to get a deal that way. So that's the way it goes.
So the two things in context here, Zelensky's talking about Europe. And he said they have given a lot. Now, the official numbers out there, they've given about as much as we've given. I know Trump says that we've given more. He says it's more like $300 billion. Again, you know, it depends on who you trust on that one, I guess. But the bottom line is, you know, his piece of that, Zelensky's, is they've given about the same. And he's very gently sort of kind of like, oh, well, just so you know, they have given a lot. Trump says, I don't think they have. He kind of taps them and they joke about it. The crowd laughs. It's totally fine, right? This is a totally fine engagement at this point. It doesn't seem like there's any animosity. There's a little tension, but that's common in these meetings. A lot of times this happens, and, you know, you just, it kind of goes on. Next up, this is talking about the situation where Biden's approach is, it comes into conversation. Now, at the end of that other clip, he talked about, like, hey, I can be as tough as you can and try to get every single inch of territory, but that's not going to get us to a deal. That's Trump's opinion. Clearly stated before this meeting, reiterated here. Then it goes on to this.
We tried the pathway of Joe Biden of thumping our chest and pretending that the president of the United States' words mattered more than the president of the United States' actions.
During a lot of years, so I'm not speaking about just Biden, but those time was Obama, then President Obama, then President Trump, then President Biden, now President Trump, and God bless, now President Trump will stop him. But during 2014, nobody stopped him. He just occupied and took. He killed people. You know what the contact
2015.
2014.
Yeah, yeah. So
I was not here.
Yeah, but
that's exactly
but,
right.
Yes,
yeah.
But during 2014 till 2022, yeah, the same, was the situation the same?
And of course, there is validity to Zelensky's point here. Obama did nothing. We criticized him at the time. They just let him roll over those borders. We did basically very little. You just take Crimea. I guess that's, we're just going to be fine with that. And obviously, it did embolden them to eventually go farther. I don't think, a coincidence when another Democrat was in office. It's not exactly a stunner that that's when that occurred. They didn't do anything during the Trump regime, and then Trump back in office again, and, you know, the whole the relationship is different. But again, this is like, he's basically saying the problem was in 2014, right? He's saying that they didn't do anything. He's saying, thankfully, that, you know, America has done some stuff afterward, but 2014, they did nothing. Again, that's a criticism of Barack Obama. We're still at the point where really this hasn't escalated at all. So, again, we've got a half an hour of these guys going back and forth, and it's very, very normal and standard, I would say. Then it does start to escalate. Watch.
What kind of diplomacy, JD, you are speaking about? What do you mean?
I'm talking about the kind of diplomacy that's going to end the destruction of your country.
Yes, but if you are not strong...
Mr. President, with respect, I think it's disrespectful for you to come into the Oval Office and try to litigate this in front of the American media. Right now, you guys are going around and forcing conscripts to the front lines because you have manpower problems. You should be thanking the president for trying to bring an end to this conflict.
But you have nice ocean. And don't feel now, but you will feel it in the future. God bless.
You don't know that.
God bless. God bless.
That.
You will not have war.
Don't tell us what we're going to feel. We're trying to solve a problem. Don't tell us what we're going to feel.
I'm not telling you.
Because
I'm
you're in no position to dictate that.
That's
Remember
exactly
this.
I'm not dictating.
You're in no position to dictate what we're going to feel. We're going to feel very good.
I mean, then it really starts going out of control. One thing that's interesting there is that you notice it's J.D. Vance who kind of steps up and is the person who kind of pushes it over. Like, I mean, everyone's like, oh, Trump is out of control. It's really Vance who escalates that a little bit there. What's fascinating about it, and I'm not being critical of Vance. I think he's making a very valid point. What's interesting about it, though, is that Vance has really been the more ideological opponent of funding Ukraine. Trump has kind of said a bunch of different stuff on Ukraine. He said they have to make a deal or they're not going to get weapons anymore. But he also said if Vladimir Putin doesn't come to the table and make a deal, we'll give more weapons to Ukraine than anybody's ever thought of. He's talked about the other side of that, too. I think Trump's ideology here is he believes this war needs to end. And that's been pretty consistent throughout his entire life. He's not a guy who wants wars. He's opposed most of them for most of the time. You know, people point out that initially he supported the Iraq war, but then changed on that. And that's, you know, true for a moment. I mean, in initial conversation, he did kind of give a little bit of support toward that effort, but generally speaking, was opposed to it most of the time. And I think typically has remained on that side of most of those conflicts. His idea is not we shouldn't support Ukraine. His idea is, I don't want this going on anymore. It's an unknown and it's creating chaos and we don't want that in the world. Vance has been on the other side of that. Vance has been like, we should not be involved in this at all. He's much more, I mean, I don't want to say isolationist because that's not exactly right, but he is much more in that road of, you know, certainly America first and more of a nationalist approach and wanting to stay out of that effort completely. with some echoes of what went on, you know, before World War One in this country. That is understandable, an understandable position that he's held for a very long time and was much more consistent about this than a lot of other politicians were much earlier. In fact, he was really more opposed to it than most of the candidates that ran in that cycle of 2022, 2023, 2024 on the Republican side. So you have that as a standard. You might say, OK, well, did he escalate that? But in the clips that we've shown, you saw that wasn't the tone of this at all until Zelensky started kind of edging in there and trying to make these points. And I want to get into why that's the wrong approach quite clearly. But let me give you the rest of this exchange, more of the fireworks, if you will, between Trump, Zelensky and Vance.
You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having cards.
Playing cards.
Right now, you're playing cards.
Mr. President. I'm serious.
You're gambling with the lives of millions of people.
You're gambling with World War III. What do you think?
You're gambling with World War III.
Have you said thank you once?
A lot of times.
No, in this
even
entire
today,
meeting that you said thank
even
you.
Even today.
You went to Pennsylvania and campaigned for the opposition in October. Oh. Offer some words of appreciation for the United States of America and the president who's trying to save your country.
And again, Zelensky has said thank you to America generally a bunch of times. Hasn't been as effusive in that praise for President Trump specifically, though he has, to be fair, has said that many, many times. The Trump part of it, of course, he's worried he's going to lose this funding. How do you approach Trump when that's your situation? Do you argue with him like that? Is that the right way to go? Here's a little bit more with Trump kind of going after Zelensky.
Your country is in big trouble.
I know.
You're not winning.
I know.
You're not winning this. You have a damn good chance of coming out okay because of us.
Mr. President, we are staying in our country, staying strong from the very beginning of the war. We've been alone, and we are thankful. I said thanks
in
this cabinet, and not only in this cabinet.
We gave you, through this stupid president, $350 billion.
You voted for your
president. We gave you military equipment, and
your
men are brave, but they had to use our military.
What about West?
If you didn't have our military equipment, if you didn't have our military equipment, this war would have been over in 2 weeks.
In three days. I heard it from Putin. In 3 days.
I mean, this is not the way to act to him. I will say, it reminds me almost of like a moderator in one of the presidential debates where they're just arguing with him and just cutting him off and like, oh my gosh, like, what are you doing? I don't think we have the photo, but there's a photo of the ambassador from Ukraine, the American ambassador, just head and hands like, no, please, please, not this. Because this is going off the rails. It ends with Trump making a very astute observation.
This is going to be great television, I will say that.
Well, that's true. It was great television. I don't think it's what Ukraine really wants, though, out of this situation. If you're trying to make great television, which, again, that has been an interest of Zelensky in the past as a comedian and a guy who was on television. Maybe that was his thought. He certainly succeeded in that. Now, look, Zelensky has had this issue of not being thankful enough before. This actually happened with Joe Biden as well in 2022. Biden lost temper with Zelensky in a June phone call when Ukrainian leader asked for more aid. To remind you about that story, Biden had barely finished telling Zelensky he had just greenlighted another $1 billion in U.S. military assistance for Ukraine when Zelensky started listing all the additional help he needed and wasn't getting. Biden lost his temper. The people familiar with the call said the American people were being quite generous, and his administration and the U.S. military were working hard to help Ukraine, he said, raising his voice, and Zelensky could show a little more gratitude, which is probably something you should do. When people give you billions of dollars, you say thank you. That, of course, happened behind the scenes, leaked to the media, but happened behind the scenes on a phone call, and that is the typical way these things happen. Those conversations do happen. A lot of them do look like that with foreign leaders. That's okay. Just shouldn't happen in front of cameras. Now, Europe, the reaction to this, Europe is doubling down, backing Zelensky after the Trump blow-up. Here is Keir Starmer, the new PM of the UK, with his commentary.
First, we will keep the military aid flowing and keep increasing the economic pressure on Russia to strengthen Ukraine now. Second, we agreed that any lasting peace must ensure Ukraine's sovereignty and security, and Ukraine must be at the table. Third, in the event of a peace deal, we will keep boosting Ukraine's own defensive capabilities to deter any future invasion. Fourth, we will go further to develop a coalition of the willing to defend a deal in Ukraine and to guarantee the peace. Not every nation will feel able to contribute, but that can't mean that we sit back. Instead, those willing will intensify planning now with real urgency. The UK is prepared to back this with boots on the ground and planes in the air. Together with others.
I don't think I can take any more of this guy. He's the most boring guy in the entire world. I think we just lost half the audience in the middle of that clip. gosh, he's dull. Anyway, there you go. They're standing by him, and they're going to give him a bunch more money, supposedly. Moscow, of course, reacting the exact opposite way. They're very excited about this fighting. Moscow reacts with glee to berating Zelensky and pushes on with restoring U.S. ties. Now, there's a lot of strategy that goes into this type of stuff, obviously. You could see as this develops, I think Trump, Glenn made a couple of really good points on radio today about how after this develops, what do you do with this information? One of the things that could work out well for us potentially with closer ties to Russia is if we can convince them to cut ties with China, perhaps that could be an advantage to us. Maybe we can secure, disillusion of that sort of burgeoning alliance, and that could be a positive for us. But I want to focus more on just like Zelensky in this moment. You got to understand what you're doing, okay? You got to understand what you're doing. Going into Donald Trump and in front of the media and trying to berate him and hand wave away the points he's making is an absolutely insane strategy. Your only job is to get off the stage. That is your job in that meeting. You're in front of the press. You're not going to solve any of these issues talking it out in front of the press. Your job is to get off the stage. When Trump or when he says you're being disrespectful to try to litigate this, if you let it go that far, which you never should. But if it gets to that point, your job is to stand there and say, you know what, Mr. Vice President, you're totally right. This is not we have so much in common and we don't need to talk about every one of our differences in front of the media. I look forward to a very fruitful conversation we can have here in the next moments behind the scenes. Whatever it is, you get off the stage. You say, you know what, Mr. President, you have been so generous to us, blah, blah, blah. Even if you don't mean a word of it, you say that over and over and over again. You compliment President Trump. You say he's the most wonderful guy in the whole world. Have we learned nothing about how you get anywhere with Donald Trump? I mean, Did RFK Jr. get far with Donald Trump when he was calling him a fascist? No. When he started saying, hey, he's great on MAHA, all of a sudden he's in the cabinet. Right? Like, this is how you deal with Donald Trump if you actually want returns from it. And especially when you're in the situation where, look, it's just by our charity that Ukraine is getting this support. The fact that we're trying to support them in a war, I don't think is their fault. We did that for a long time. There has to be an end to it. The standard of Joe Biden is absurd. It's not as much as you need for as long as it takes. That's an absurd standard. There has to be limits on that. And we're trying to communicate to them, dude, you're bumping up against that wall right now. If you want our support, you better come to the table and get it fixed. I think that's a totally rational approach, especially from a new president. You need to get off the stage. Now, if you watch that buildup that we played you, if Zelensky had taken that approach, that would have been a very normal, boring exchange. That is your goal. Your goal is not to provide entertainment in that moment. Your goal is to get off the stage and bore people as much as possible so no one says anything about it. That's your job. And he fell down on that job. And you could say Trump should have just not taken the bait, should not have fought with him. Understandable. Now, a lot of this has to do with it does align with his actual opinion on this stuff. And he's not going to back down and take that in front of the media. You have to know going into that meeting what you're up against. And Zelensky, I don't know, did he? It's just absolutely massive mistake. And I don't know how any of that is beneficial to Zelensky. If he wants to keep that funding, be nice. So three possibilities here before I take a break here and we're going to go into something else. But you could say, was this a premeditated blow up by someone like Trump or maybe even Vance? Right. We discussed that at the beginning. I think when you watch the footage back and watch the half hour lead up, there's no evidence to say that they wanted that to happen there. I don't think that was what was going on. Number two, which is very possible, it was just a natural blow up. You have two people that are TV entertainers that know what this stuff looks like, that both have big egos, and they started butting heads, and then neither one of them wanted to back down. Very, very possible that's it. The third possibility is kind of interesting in that, was this something that was sort of a strategic inflammation by Zelensky? Did he want to come here? Because he could have signed this agreement, obviously, staying in Ukraine. He wanted to come here to make a show of it. The fact that he would allow that to happen after coming here is kind of stunning. And you wonder, is this a calculated sort of approach from Zelensky? Let me just give you one thing that kind of backs that up. And I don't know if this means if it's 100% down that road, but it doesn't prove it, but it does back it up. Disaster in the Oval Office. Dems lead Zelensky and Ukraine off a cliff with pressure to reject mineral deal. A common criticism of Zelensky's disastrous Friday performance in the Oval Office was that he failed to read the room. Actually, the Ukrainian president did read a room, but it was the wrong room. Before meeting with President Trump, Zelensky met with anti-Trump Democrats who advised him to reject the terms of the mineral deal that the president was offering, according to Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat of Connecticut. So this is not like some behind-the-scenes sourcing. He said, just finished a meeting with President Zelensky here in Washington. He confirmed that the Ukrainian people will not support a fake peace agreement where Putin gets everything he wants and there are no security arrangements in Ukraine. Instead of just taking that behind the scenes, he decided to go farther and farther and farther, which led to that inflammation that you saw. And down the road, this sort of snowball into hell that we all kind of witnessed the other day. This probably winds up being a faster path to a policy that I think most of us agree with, which is we need to cut this funding off at some point, and maybe sooner rather than later. We also want a resolution to this war. So I don't think this is bad for the United States, but Ukraine has put itself in a terrible position. It may have calculated, hey, we get the American left along with Europe on our side. That's probably better than what we're going to get if we go in there and kiss butt, because we've already lost Trump. We've already lost the American right. That could have been the calculation. I don't know if it's the right calculation, but it could have been what he's doing there. We'll just have to keep watching the background reporting and see where this goes from here. Again, it's not about what people say. It's what people do. And we'll continue to moderate that going forward on this incredibly important situation, which, again, we're talking about potential World War III. So we really want to avoid that. We'll get into more here in just a minute.
Kaffee in seiner besten Form mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Tchibo. In jeder Cubo-Kapsel steckt Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Für Espresso, Kaffeecrema oder Kaffeegrande auf Knopfdruck. Die neue Cubo One überzeugt mit Premium-Design, kompakter Größe und kleinem Einstiegspreis ab 29 Euro. Dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie wird jede Tasse besonders aromatisch mit samtiger Crema. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo-Kapselmaschinen in deiner Tchibo-Filiale und auf Tchibo.de.
I want to bring in Ryan Burge. He's a political science professor at Eastern Illinois University and the research director for Faith Counts. I reached out after reading his piece, The God Gap in American Politics. It's on his Substack. I'll share a link to it over on my X page. Ryan, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Sue. Appreciate having me.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story you have here. And, you know, I think we've all heard this thing that people are stepping away from faith, that we're a less religious country, more people are atheists or no religion, agnostic. And it's kind of been a trend you've heard about maybe for a couple of decades. You kind of dove into the numbers a little bit more deeply. I want to show one of your graphs here to just start this off, and you kind of take us, maybe you can give us an explanation as to what's going on here. When you break it down by party, the difference in the share of people who believe in God without a doubt from the 1980s till today, Republicans relatively flat, 66% in 1985, 63%, I guess 1987 or 88, 63% today. So a 3-point drop off a little bit. Independents, you have a little bit more significant drop off from 59% down to 51. And then Democrats, a massive drop off, really with a lot of it very recent, from 63% down to 39%. When you look at that data, what is the story that is told?
Yeah, so in political science, we've been talking about, there's a book in the 1990s called The Great Divide, and it was kind of hinting at this idea that the Republican Party was going, actually not going one direction, staying where they were, and the Democratic Party was going the other direction. And what we've seen more and more over the last 25 years is that God gap has really sorted itself out now, where the Republican Party is definitely the party of religious people, and the Democratic Party has become the party of a couple different groups, you know, Black Protestants, Hispanic Catholics, but also atheists, agnostics, and nothing in particular. So the party, the Republican Party has stayed relatively white and Christian. It's still 75% white Christians today. The Democratic Party, however, is 45% non-religious now and only about 35% white Christians. So also Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and Black Protestants and Hispanic Catholics. So in some ways, the Republican Party looks like what America looked like 30 or 40 years ago. And I think the Democratic Party is banking on the fact they're going to look like what America will look like in 30 or 40 years from now.
Yeah. So it's more, I mean, is it that like sort of cold and political? Is it a calculation that they're moving this way? Is it just that the people who are drifting into the sort of no religion circles are attracted to their messaging? What do you see as the cause of that?
So for a long time in political science, we used to think that religion was first and politics lived downstream of that. So, you know, your church, your pastor, the Pope, your theology taught you who to vote for, and then you voted for that candidate. What we're realizing more and more now is that people pick their church based on their politics. So politics is first and religion lives downstream of politics. So whether someone chooses to go to an evangelical church or a Catholic mass or no religion at all, that's really a political calculation. So we've seen sort of religious sorting is what we would call it over the last 20 or 30 years. So it's very, very hard, for instance, to be a Democrat who's a white evangelical. And it's really, really hard to be a Republican who's an atheist. So we're seeing people want to live unified lives. They want all their identities to line up in a very consistent way. And listen, religion at the end of the day is voluntary. You can choose if you go, where you go, how often you go, what kind of church you go to. And people are going to pick a house of worship that aligns with their political, you know, how they see the political world.
I mean, it's I don't know. This strikes me as very bad. I don't know if you see it the same way. I mean, maybe it's just, you know, it's just natural human instinct. But like there's a flow to it that I understand the other way, which is like you come up with a basis of principle. You come up with a foundation, things that you believe early on in life. Those things drive your, you know, if you lack of a better term, ideology, where you support certain policies, you support certain approaches to things. And then that would drive you into a political party. Like, I mean, working in politics for too long, like for that to be the leader into something as eternal and important as your faith, it strikes me as really having it backwards.
Well, listen, I was a pastor for 20 years. And, you know, I think there's nothing salvific about politics. Let's be clear about that. There's nothing that happens there that I think is good for us as human. It's a necessary part of life because I'm a political scientist. I understand we have to figure out who gets what, when, where, and how. But at the same time, politics will always disappoint you. It will always let you down. It will drive wedges in society. And I think the problem is, though, is what we've seen in modern American politics is the church has become very much a monoculture. And I think this is problematic, whether that was being 80% Democrats or 80% Republicans, because my understanding of faith is it belongs to everyone. It should be for everyone, that everyone should feel welcome in a faith community if they want to feel welcome in a faith community. But unfortunately, you know, the number one predictor of people leaving being a non-religious person right now is their political ideology. About 50% of liberals are non-religious. It's only 12% of conservatives. So I think this political divide has actually emptied the pews out quite a bit. And for some Christians, I think that's a good thing. We want only the real, what they call the true believers at church. But I think church was better when you had Democrats sitting side by side with Republicans. That's how you build tolerance and social capital and understanding and all the things that seem to be in short supply in America right now. Churches used to be the engines of democracy and the engines of social capital. And now because they've become so one note, we're not seeing that mixing and matching and that heterogeneity that we need in American society.
Yeah, and I think like some people hear that and would think, well, I don't want my church to give up on their principles. I want them to stick with what they believe is true. And sometimes when you're just trying to make the tent bigger, you can, you know, easily, understandably, kind of like maybe make those lines a little bit softer. That's not necessarily what you're suggesting, though, right? Like, I mean, it's important that the principles stay the same, but is it just a different way of messaging it? Is it more about just understanding the ins and outs of life? How do you solve that?
For me, I always want to separate life into dogma versus doctrine. You know, and dogmas are things that we can't change about faith. For instance, I believe in the Apostles' Creed. That's my dogma. Everything else above that to me is doctrine. You know, whether it be women in the leadership or views of same-sex marriage or whatever else, those are doctrinal issues. And different groups of people can disagree on those issues. And I think there's very good arguments, you know, to disagree on those issues, but it shouldn't drive us apart as other people. I think the problem is we demonize the other side. You know, a lot of evangelicals will say that atheists are godless and they're moral, you know, they have no moral foundation and they're terrible people. And a lot of atheists call evangelicals bigots and racists and xenophobes. That is not helpful. That's not helpful for any of us. I think if you look at America, and I'm actually writing a book right now, one of the chapters is we're not as polarized as we think we are. The average American tends to be sensible, middle of the road, moderate. They're looking for compromise. Unfortunately, it's the loudest voices on the far left and the far right that seem to drive our conversation. And a lot of Americans are sitting in the middle going, yeah, but I don't really agree with you, or I don't really agree with you either. I want to find a common sense compromising solution, but moderates don't march. That's the problem. It's only people on the very far edges. And I think we've got to remember that the average person is fairly sensible on these issues. And we can't forget them in the debate.
Well, remember, I'm also lazy and out of shape, so I don't march either, whether a moderate or not. Let me give you another one of these graphs from your article. This is how often do you attend religious services? And you see, you know, back in the 70s, a pretty even percentage that go all the time and none of the time from both parties. Now we're at a situation where it really is considerably different. Democrats never go about half the time. I guess if you include seldom as well, you're about almost half. That percentage much more... much lower, around in the 30s for Republicans. Same thing when it comes to people going all the time, about a 13 to 15 point gap there. The movement is significant, and you know, I don't know what it says for the future. Is this something that just keeps continuing, or do you think this is evening off?
Well, so Pew just released a report last week, and I've been writing about this for a while, that the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, have stopped rising in America. They're kind of stuck around 30%, and they've been at 30% for the last 3 or 4 years now, after going from 5% of America in 1991 to 30% of America in 2020. So we're definitely at an inflection point. Now, I think the nuns are going to continue to rise from there, but we're seeing a plateau. And the religiosity of Generation Z looks a whole lot like the religiosity of millennials, which is a really big deal because there's usually a huge drop off in religion from one generation to the next. We're not seeing that anymore. There's a bedrock of religion in America. Probably 55% of even the youngest Americans are religious. They're not going to become atheists, agnostics, or nothing in particular. So we're not going to go the way of Denmark or Sweden or France, you know, where it's 10% religious people. There's a core of religiosity in America that I don't think is going away. Now, attendance might continue to drop because we're not joining anything, any social groups anymore. But what we're going to see is a lot of people still believe in God a whole lot. And actually, belief in the afterlife has gone up over the last 30 years in America. So there's lots of evidence out there that we are still a deeply religious country, even as we see some of these other metrics go the opposite direction.
That's actually really encouraging. You mentioned the younger ages, and I think we hear obviously a lot of really bad things about younger groups. It's interesting to see that they're not falling off in that same way. I think that's encouraging. I wanted to pull something else that was unrelated to your article that you actually posted, I think, late last year, which I found fascinating and did not know. The question was, and I kind of looked at this as like, hey, there actually are some good things happening in America, which we don't cover that often. But the question was, have you ever consumed alcohol or smoked cigarettes? And, you know, we kind of get the sense, especially with cigarettes, there's been a drop off there. But the this is among high school seniors. The drop offs are significant for podcast listeners. Let me just describe them quickly. In 19, like, say, 75, 92% of high school seniors had alcohol. That number's dropped from 92 to 53%. Smoking has been even more dramatic. You might expect some of that, from 76% to only 17%. These are massively positive changes, and I feel like this type of stuff never gets covered.
Oh, I'll give you another statistic. 15 to 19 year old girls, the teen pregnancy rate, 75% in the last 30 years. So we're seeing a massive drop off in a lot of the bad things in American society.
Okay. I think you, did you say 75%? Is that what you said?
75% drop in teen pregnancy.
Okay, good. We lost. We kept losing it there, but that is a massive, massive drop off and a really, really positive change, obviously. And, you know, you just, I don't know, you don't hear about that. I know there's some, you know, some people like to push back and say, well, vaping started and there's more marijuana and there is some effect there, but it's generally pretty small, right, Ryan?
Yeah, so marijuana consumption is the same today as it was 20 years ago. Now, vaping is a problem, but it's not a problem. The kids are not doing as many drugs or alcohol things today as they were 30 or 40 years ago. They're not replacing one thing for another thing, but I will say there might be some bad news here. Young people are not hanging out anymore. They're not going on dates at the same level. They're not just hanging out with friends at the same level. They're not getting jobs at the same level they did even 25 years ago. So really, it's kind of it's a multifaceted thing. These are good things. Obviously, the kids aren't smoking weed and drinking beers at the same rate or having sex, you know, promiscuous sex especially. But at the same time, they're also struggling with things like anxiety and depression and loneliness, too. So it's not an unalloyed good. There's definitely some goods and bads in all of these things. But in some ways, I think Generation Z represents a change in the guard, things moving in the opposite direction.
Well, I mean, some real positives there, some scary stuff as well. It'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. Ryan Burge, a political science professor and research director for Faith Counts. Be sure to check out his piece on Substack as well, The God Gap in American Politics. You can find a link over on my X page. I mean, Ryan's always posting really interesting stuff that kind of gives you a different perspective on what's actually going on in the world. Ryan, I really appreciate you taking the time, and thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks so much, man. It's been a pleasure.
Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer gut, immer günstig, immer vielfältig. Kurz gesagt, frische für alle. Zum Aldi-Preis. Diese Woche Cespri Sangold Kiwi. Das Stück für nur 55 Cent. Oder dunkle Tafeltrauben. 500 Gramm für nur 1,79 Euro. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
I know what needs to be done, and I know how to do it.
I know how to do
it. Experience matters. Leading New York City in the midst of a crisis is not the time or the place for on-the-job training. Did I always do everything right in my years of government service? Of course not.
Of course not.
Would I do some things differently, knowing what I know now?
Knowing what I know now.
Did I make mistakes?
Some painfully? Stand this guy.
Definitely. And I believe I learned from them.
I learned from them.
And that I am a better person for it. And I hope to show you that
every day. I'm a better person
for
it.
But I promise you this.
All my groping made me better.
I know what needs to be done. And I know how to do it.
I know how
and
to do it.
I will give it my all to get the job done.
God, this is going to be
and
infuriating.
And it will get done.
This is going to be, I beg of you to just try to help me get through this process. Andrew Cuomo, I don't have time to hit this entire thing right now. We need to do a full monologue on Cuomo this week. That's coming. It's right around the corner. But remember, he's going to grope people less. Got to kill fewer old people. It's the Andrew Cuomo guarantee. So get ready for that one. By the way, I did want to give you some good news today, which is border crossings. Now, Trump obviously has cracked down on the border. We are now seeing migrants crossing the U.S. southern border, plunging to a level not seen in at least 25 years. Border Patrol recorded about 8,450 apprehensions. There were some times during the Biden administration, they'd get 8,000 in a day. They're getting 8,450 in a month now. Incredible. And the only month that was even close to this was April 2017, very early on in Trump term number one. So I think there's a little bit of a trend here. Now, I will say, after those early months of the first term, those numbers did come up. They didn't come up anywhere near where Biden was, but they were higher. It will be interesting to see if policy can chase the tone here and make these long-lasting changes. But a very positive development early on, even in the first few weeks of the Trump administration, that we're going to continue to watch very, very closely right here on Stu Does America. All right, President Trump is about to deliver his first address to Congress since returning to the White House. And you know exactly how this goes. The media is ready to spin every word, but not here. We're not going to do that. Blaze Media is bringing you the speech live and uncensored with real-time analysis from the best minds in conservative media. No spin, no establishment talking points, just the truth. That's the way we like to do things around here. And this could not come at a more critical moment. Just days ago, of course, we talked about at the beginning of the show, Trump clashing with Zelensky over cutting U.S. military aid to Ukraine. sending Washington into a panic. On top of that, his administration just announced the new tariffs with China and Canada and Mexico. All that's going on. We've got potentially a tax cut on around the corner, too, they want to pass. So what happens next? Will Trump find a plan to fix all this? Will he go to the swamp and have them try to stop him? We all know these are possibilities. We're going to be covering it all with no filler and no fluff. Watch it live Tuesday, March 4th, 7:30 p.m. That's tomorrow. Right here on Blaze TV, YouTube, Rumble, all that stuff. And stay tuned for an exclusive preview of Glenn Beck's NASA whistleblower special. That's coming up as well. Do not miss it.